My guest tonight is Greg Palast, investigative reporter, a real hard-boiled, irascible, take-no-prisoner kind of guy, a dying breed, really. If you thought investigative journalism is dead, think again. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something called the dead end game, or the end game, rather, a secret document that Greg uncovered, which really points to corruption in the highest levels within the financial world, which may have actually kickstarted the economic collapse of 2008. And, of course, that can has simply been kicked down the road, and we're staring another virtual collapse in the face yet again. We'll also talk about vulture funds and how the people that run these vulture funds, it really gives a bad name to the bird, but these vulture funds are essentially exploiting the most vulnerable people on earth, people living in impoverished countries that make less than a dollar a day. And he'll tell you who is responsible for this and how they are doing it. Greg Palast, my guest, here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't you dare go away. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett, along with Greg Palast, author of the New York Times bestsellers Billionaires and Ballot Bandits and Armed Madhouse, also the best money democracy money can buy, and the highly acclaimed Vulture's Picnic, which was named Book of the Year 2012 on BBC Newsnight Review. Now, I know you want to spend a few moments, Greg, and talk about why the elites really are betting on New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to be the next occupant of the White House, although I'm a little perplexed by that, given that the recent Conservative Political Action Conference last week, Christie placed fourth with a mere 8%, way, way behind Rand Paul.
Yeah, well, remember that they picked Michelle Bachmann before, too, so... they don't pick nothing. It's the billionaires will just tell you who, you know. Yeah, Michelle Bachmann won that, and Mr. Romney was their candidate. They're one of a billionaire buddy. That's how it works. Mr. McCain, who can't count his houses, became their candidate in the Republican Party. Billionaire carries a candidate. Look, so the votes, like we always say, the votes don't count. Christie was had a secret meeting with David Koch back in January of last year, and they wanted. And after that meeting, which was never on his records, I found out about it. He flew and had a secret meeting with the rest of the Koch brothers and some other billionaires, including a guy known as the Iceman, and that's their boy. That was also a secret meeting. Was not on his schedule. His entire trip to Colorado was not on his schedule. And suddenly there was a bunch of ads put on the air about that Chris Christie, you know, was the greatest thing since sliced bread, put out by something called Campaign for Our Children's Future. When the New York Times investigated, and they're not investigators, they said, oh, it was Christie's college friends. He went to a low-level college. He's not investment bankers from Yale. He went to, like, Seton Hall. And, you know, where did this money come from? Pretty soon those ads add up to over $6 million. I went back in my files. Committee for Our Children's Future was an old front used by the Koch brothers as a shill for campaign contributions from their corporation. When it was illegal, this was now it's legal, and they're back. So they've picked their boy. Now, he ran into some trouble playing with the traffic cones on the George Washington Bridge, so that may have killed him off.
Yes.
Now they gotta come. They may have to come up with a new one. But you have to understand, they want someone that they can elect, and, you know, I don't think they're going to find Rand Paul electable. The billionaires want to win this one, and if not, they'll do what they did in 08. The billionaires, I mean, J.P. Morgan, Citibank's Robert Rubin, Penny Pritzker, who's now our Secretary of the Treasury, who was from Superior Bank until she was barred by law from having anything to do with the bank. Fined $400 million. Basically, a banking criminal is now our Secretary of Commerce. They picked, you know, this state senator from Chicago, you know, not exactly presidential material, and put him in the White House.
So why should people vote? Listening to you, Greg, people listening are throwing up their hands and saying, no. Well, why bother?
Because they can't steal all the votes all the time. We have to make them steal your vote. Don't hand it to them. I hate it when people just say, oh, give up, what's the point? Yeah, Make them work. They can't steal every vote every time. We've had tremendous movements in this country, including the United States of America is part of an uprising of people against the World Trade Organization at one time, which was, used to be known as the British Empire. You know, so we do win some. Okay, we do win some. Okay, let's not forget that. All right. So,
all right.
So I don't want people to get discouraged. It just means that you know, you can't win with 50% of the vote. You got to win with 56% of the vote. They can't steal every vote every time. That's how it works. And you know, they can't keep every show off the air. Yeah. Okay. So you coast to coast in the middle of the night, but we're on the air.
So true far. Enough. All right. I want to. We're coming up in about a month. We are. We'll be looking at the fourth anniversary of the Deep Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf.
Yes.
And I mean, that features prominently in your latest Palace Investigates, Vultures and Vote Rustlers.
That's right.
We tend to, you know, these things blow up in the news and then we tend to forget them with our 48-hour. Yeah, so let's just revisit that and remind people again what happened. And then
okay.
I want to talk about the British Petroleum cover-up.
Yes. April 20th, 2010, the Deepwater Horizon British Petroleum rig in the Gulf of Mexico blows out and blows up. 11 men are incinerated, and nearly 1,000 miles of Gulf coastline are slathered with crud and destroyed, okay? And then that was, so the beaches get covered, then the cover-up begins. And so in, you know, if you go to, again, you can see a little bit of it in GregPalast.com, Vultures and Vote Rustlers. I got a call right after the blowout. Not a call, I got a message, and I won't say how the message came in, but it came in from another oil rig, a BP, someone near a BP oil rig in the Caspian Sea, that said, this is not the first BP blowout. It's happened before. I said, how do you cover up a blowout? The answer is bribery, beatings, brutality, you name it. British Petroleum had a prior blowout in the Caspian Sea just a year and a half before the Deepwater Horizon blowout. The same thing, the same cause. They use this cheap cement process called quick dry cement. Every day of that you save on a rig is $500,000 rental savings. So they use this cheapo method. It blew out once, and they covered up that it blew out again in the Gulf. Of course, in the Gulf of Mexico, they couldn't cover it up. But they covered up that they previously had done it. I get this message, and I travel for British television because American TV ain't going to take this on. I fly across the world to the nation of Azerbaijan. If you've never heard of Azerbaijan, don't feel bad. It's one of those nations pooped out by the Soviet Union when it collapsed. I call it the Islamic Republic of BP. BP owns that place. And I go in, and sure enough, I get arrested. Okay, I'm going across the desert.
First, let me apologize to all our Azerbaijani listeners. you should be working for the tourist board.
If they're listening to this, they're listening to it under covers, you know. Believe me, if you're Azerbaijani, you know exactly what's going on there. And I'm heading across the desert, the roadless desert, to try to find these witnesses, and I get arrested because someone's, ratted us out. And they grab the film. They try to grab the film, but my assistant, Ms. Badpenny, that's her name, gave me one of those Austin Powers cameras inside a pen. They let me keep the pen. And so I have film of that arrest. I get out. I'm thrown out of the country. And I'm having trouble getting the proof that there was a prior blowout. But I finally found the stone-cold proof because they disappeared my witnesses. Terrifying there. They disappeared my witnesses. I get the proof from a witness named Private Bradley Manning, the guy who released the WikiLeaks documents.
Now Chelsea Manning.
Now Chelsea Manning, right? Whatever he wants to be, I don't care. But I'll tell you this, the guy had the guts to give out the information. And in that, people don't talk about what's in that stuff. I went through that stuff. I'm with The Guardian. We had the access, right? And what's in that was the U.S. State Department knew that there was a BP blowout in Azerbaijan, and they covered it up. Exxon knew, Chevron knew, because they were BP's partners there. the State Department knew under Condoleezza Rice. Now, why would Condoleezza Rice, who had been a board member of Chevron Corporation, they have a tanker named the Condoleezza, okay, why would she cover up for Chevron, I wonder? So they covered this up.
Not connecting any dots.
Not, I don't want to make any connections. Someone might get upset. And so the our Secretary of State from Chevron covers up the Chevron Exxon BP explosion in the Gulf, blowout in the Gulf, the same thing, excuse me, in the Caspian Sea. It happens again in the Gulf. No one says a word. It's completely covered up, completely. Even though it's sitting there in the State Department WikiLeaks documents, we have the witnesses, we have the information. I can't get this out in U.S. media for anything. It's on primetime television all over the rest of the world. Switzerland, London, South America. You can't get this important information on the U.S. That's why I appreciate you're putting it on right now. That's why I put it in this little film that you can download. But so the thing is that the – so they lied about this, and these guys died. And this coast is destroyed. Now they say. Now you say people are forgetful about what happened with the Deepwater Horizon. Of course they are, because they're we're told, oh, nature's cleaned it all up. If anyone's on the Gulf Coast, they know it's baloney, but on the Gulf Coast they can't hear you scream, right? You're not in New York. You're not in Los Angeles where the shows are all produced and stuff. People don't know. You go to the beaches off Gulfport, Mississippi. You go to those shoals. You dig down 4, 5, 6 inches, and you're going to hit dried or crumbled or even still some liquid crude. You got sheen still coming out. It's still poison. It's going to be poisonous for 40 years.
And who are the people that are working? Who are the people that are doing the cleanup? These are the people that basically their lives were destroyed by the spill to begin with.
That's right. I went out there. I actually went, after I came back from Azerbaijan, I went down to the Gulf. And, you know, they said, this is after the Obama administration and BP jointly announced that the nature cleaned up everything. And I'm out there, and there's still cleanup crews out there. So I said, what's this? And they had, they were sitting there literally with, you'll see in the film, kitty litter scoopers, pooper scoopers, picking up hydrocarbon off the surface, all of the lumps of tar. And they said, why are you just, like, skimming the surface? They said, well, you can't. We're not allowed to dig. These are people who are earning, okay, they're earning $14 an hour. They're not wearing any hazmat suits. When I was up in Alaska, I was an investigator on the Exxon Valdez spill. People were wearing head-to-toe garb with respirators. Also, these people are out in T-shirts. They're wearing baggies over their shoes. They're in 90-degree heat. They're playing with toxins, and they're getting half the amount that people got 20 years earlier cleaning the other stuff. These are people who all lost their jobs because the casinos along the Gulf Coast all closed because it's still no one wanted to go down there. Everyone, people lost their homes, their livelihoods, everything. And then they're, what are they told to do? Well, for a third of your former pay, you can go out and pick up tar balls in the sun. And this is what people... This is our new job. This is the job creation. You know, they talk about the rich job creators. Well, there they were. They're creating jobs, picking up tar balls. And it's still out there. That's the other lie. They had had a prior blowout. And this week, the Obama administration announced that BP is now going to be allowed to resume operations. And this week will be bidding on new Gulf tracks. So imagine if someone, you know, drops oil all over your living room, you know, and then they announce, they're going to move back in. They haven't cleaned up everything, but they're moving back into your place. Now get out of the way.
Well, in your Vultures and Vote Rustlers, there's a clip of BP Vice President, former BP Vice President David Rayner, yes, testifying. I think it's a U.S. Senate hearing.
Yes.
This is before Deep Horizon blows, and he's assuring the Senate that this type of oil rig drilling can be done safely and it's never failed before. And, of course, he's talking about this after the cover-up of the Caspian Sea oil rig.
Right.
So isn't that perjury? I mean, isn't that against the law, what he was doing?
Well, guess what? I mean, I've been doing a lot of work. He was indicted for perjury, for obstruction that you'll see in the film. You'll see a stamp, a big felony stamp across him. He was indicted for felony obstruction of Congress. But okay, the full story of the cover-up wasn't, because, see, remember, the State Department knew, so they can't push this. So they suddenly, the case has been indefinitely against BP's vice president, has been indefinitely adjourned. Because once they open this up, he's going to say, yeah, I lied. But I lied because the State Department told me to lie. Your own State Department is in on it, and we agreed it's not public. So I can't. You can't say I withheld information from Congress because the State Department could have told you.
Did you confront any other BP officials about this cover-up?
Yeah. What happened was they said, under British law, I had to give them all my information where they can respond. And they said, oh, well, we told the Azerbaijan government. Now, that's pretty funny because I'm sure that the information was wrapped in a check. Because what happened was we also got on camera a guy who was a BP executive and an MI6 executive. That's, you know, the James Bond spy agency. Now, when I said I'm doing a story on BP, he says, oh, MI6. I said, oh, BP. He said, well, that is MI6. There's really no difference between the security agencies in Britain and British Petroleum. It's like one organization. It used to all be, remember, one government, and then they privatized it, but the spooks stayed inside. He told me himself that he personally paid millions of dollars in bribes to the Azerbaijan officials, and that Lord Brown himself, the chairman of BP, took a check of $30 million to the president of Azerbaijan. Now, by the way, the reason he can say this, just so you know, is that at the time the bribe was made, unlike the United States, it was legal to bribe foreign officials in Britain. British officials could bribe foreign officials. So he just said, this is what we did.
And you're making the case, and this gentleman, Les Abrahams, who was the insider that you speak of, make the case that the Azerbaijani regime was essentially installed by guns and intelligence supplied by BP, MI6, and the CIA.
Yes. There was a front company that was used by the CIA, which provided guns. See, because Azerbaijan, when it was pooped out of the Soviet Union, as they said, became an independent nation. It had a lot of oil. So, you know, they elected a president, some professor who was previously some dissident, and he wanted to, you know, he's a very nice guy, but he didn't want to give an exclusive contract to British Petroleum or Amoco. So what happened is that the old KGB chief was able to get guns and intelligence from MI6 and the CIA using a front company, and he names the front company in the film. And he said, and they gave the old KGB chief some guns to overthrow the elected president. And that old KGB, basically the old communist chief, suddenly became an Islamic, fervent Islamic leader. He switched from communist to Islamic in like about, 60 minutes, right? And became the new dictator, which recognized him, and then he turned it over when he died. His son took over, and the same family's been running this dictatorship, this oil dictatorship for BP. And the way BP and Amoco split the Caspian oil, Amoco, the old American oil company, BP simply bought Amoco so that they all then split up the spoils of this gigantic Caspian Sea field.
This whistleblower, Les Abrahams, that you met at the Oriental Club in London and spilled the beans, former MI6, he looked very nervous during that interview, and I was curious, what happened to him?
Well, it was clear that he was in his last days, so he figured there was nothing to lose, and it was very costly to him in the end because he had businesses in Azerbaijan, Azeri wife and everything, and, you know, as far as I tell, he kind of, to tell the truth, he lost everything.
All right.
He's recovered.
A big price to be paid, but I guess thank God that, you know, he was able to step up to the plate. Greg Palast stays with us in about a half hour's time. We'll open up the lines as well if you've got questions or comments for Greg. And when we come back, we'll talk about an interesting document that came through Greg's fax. He calls it a conspiracy nuts wet dream. We'll tell you all about the end game agreement when Coast to Coast AM continues. I'll tell you what else can shake you out of your doldrums and make you prick up your ears and take notice, and that is my guest, Greg Palast, and he'll be back in a moment with us to talk about banks and bananas and an interesting communique from Switzerland that was sent to the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, a document called the End Game Agreement, and in it, We'll learn all about, in many ways, how the economic collapse of 2008 was engineered, how it's connected to banking deregulation in the mid to late 90s, and how, if you've ever wondered how, you know, a housing market crash in California could lead to insolvency in Iceland and auto plants closing in the UK, this is one instance where Greg Palast, I think, would be happy to connect the dots. And we'll return with Greg Palast here on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back on Coast to Coast AM with Greg Palast, Richard Serrett sitting in as your humble guest host. And Greg, I wanted to ask you about this communique that was mysteriously faxed to you from Switzerland to the U.S. Treasury of the Treasury Secretary, rather, Larry Summers. It's called the Endgame Agreement. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the Endgame Memo. To me, it was sent by what was then Ambassador Timothy Geithner, who became Secretary of the Treasury under Barack Obama. Larry Summers, if you remember, was until recently Obama's economics czar, but under Clinton, Geithner, Summers, and Robert Rubin were the triumvirate that ruled the Treasury Department under Bill Clinton and deregulated the financial and banking structure. You know how well that worked. What could go wrong, right? So when they deregulated the banks and investment banks, which are basically casinos, are allowed to dip into the funds of commercial banks, which you and I guarantee, right, that we have a Treasury guarantee of these banks. You know, the banks went, nuts, wild. It was bankers gone wild, and they created insane so-called products like, toxic derivatives, mortgage-backed securities with no mortgages to back them, et cetera. It was all, bags of feces that they were selling around, hoping to sell around the world. The problem was that one of the companies were building up these balance sheets. Back in 1997 under Clinton, as soon as they deregulated, they went wild. J.P. Morgan ended up with up to $88 trillion of derivatives on its balance sheet. Let me repeat that. Not billion, $88 trillion of derivatives. Now, what do you do with this junk? Well, you get the rest of the world to buy it. You get the rest of the world to deregulate their banking system and buy this junk. And how do you do that? So the only way that they could do that, so they made Timmy Geithner, the ambassador to the World Trade Organization, the WTO, and which works hand in hand with the IMF and the World Bank, and it establishes the business order of the planet.
And they get such a warm reception wherever they go.
Yes. And if you remember the Battle of Seattle when people were throwing rocks at Starbucks over the World Trade Organization, people didn't even know what this was. What the kids in the street didn't know was that the game was up. So they Geithner wrote Summers, Geithner out in Geneva, where the World Trade Organization is based, wrote a memo to Summers reminding him to call the boys. Now, who are the boys? It was the CEO of Goldman Sachs, of J.P. Morgan Chase, of Bank of America, of Citibank, Merrill. I mean, basically, they were discussing, apparently, these bankers were having, what this memo indicates, the bankers were having secret meetings to write the trade rules. The idea is we would use trade legislation to force every nation on the planet to accept our toxic junk assets. And they did. And so that's how when the California market, housing market fell apart, Iceland melted, pensions in Finland went under, the whole world economy collapsed.
What's in it for what's in it for a country like Ecuador, to take these toxic derivatives?
Right. So they didn't want to do it. So what they did was, so the U.S. ambassador told Geithner, and the banks said, if you don't allow J.P. Morgan to open up offices to sell derivatives in your country, if you don't allow your banks to open up and move their money to Miami, here's what we're going to do. Ecuador really is a banana republic. And I spoke to, by the way, the president of Ecuador about this memo. By the way, how do I get these memos? That's my job as an investigative reporter. I get these. Obviously, this stuff is really confidential. Because, by the way, the meetings of the bankers and our treasury officials, that's illegal because they can't have these secret meetings. They can't have public hearings. But they
is that
can't
like the Logan Act
memos.
And contravention of the Logan Act or something?
Yeah, it's, I, I, It's elite. Yeah, you cannot have a secret. You can't have a series of secret meetings in which interested parties write legislation and treaties of the United States. You can have hearings. They can discuss it openly. That's perfectly legal. And by the way, how do I know this was authentic? I actually flew to Switzerland, met with the director general of WTO, authenticated that, then went, and you know what? They had the private phone numbers of these bankers. So I did the obvious thing. I called them. No secretaries or anything. I got right to the CEO of Citibank. Bank.
Who was another former secretary of the Treasury, I believe.
Yeah, so what happens, Robert Rubin later, he was secretary of the Treasury, cuts this deal. He goes to Citibank after he was treasurer under U.S. Treasury Secretary under Clinton. 6 months after he leaves Treasury, which is, by the way, supposed to be a year break, but he goes 6 months afterwards, and he is paid by Citibank $110 million, like that, $110 million to become co-chairman of Citigroup, which then collapses and requires a $4 trillion backup by the U.S. Treasury and about $80 billion in direct subsidy, bailout money. So Rubin comes up with this deregulation scheme, blows out Citibank. They pay him $110 million and he gets the Treasury to back him up. I think he was robbed. Only being paid $110 million to get that type of, you know, billions and trillions, trillions in backing, billions in cash. And he only got $110 million. I think he was robbed, actually.
Poor fella. But then
I flew to Ecuador, met with the president of Ecuador, and showed him some of the inside documents. Not only this, but other inside documents from the IMF and World Bank. And he said, I suspected this. These were secret agreements cut with a finance minister. The presidents of these countries are often not told, in case they object. And so these are secret agreements with his finance minister, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO that were signed off, which basically blew apart Ecuador's financial system. But they had to go along with it because Ecuador really is a banana republic. It's their main export. Well, until recently when oil finally took over. But they basically survived by selling us bananas. And we said, we will not buy your bananas. What are you going to do, feed them to the monkeys? We won't buy your bananas unless you open up your banks to us. And they did. The economy collapsed. The banks collapsed in Ecuador right after that. And the Quechua Indians came down from the mountains. I went down to Ecuador at the time. They burnt down the capital because they were hungry. So we have to understand the problem of this stuff is that it has worldwide consequences, and it comes back to haunt us. And, of course, it came back, you know, the financial destruction worldwide washed right back to the U.S., and we were, you know, we suffered big time. The banks did okay. They were protected and bailed out, and, you know, these guys, you know, they made bonuses.
Too big to jail.
It's insane. Yeah.
Who went to jail?
Let's see. No one. Oh, you know what? The jail. I did one story. One of the investment bankers working with Goldman Sachs, a guy named Paulson, John Paulson, not Hank Paulson, not the Secretary of Treasury, we had a Secretary of Treasury who was the CEO of Goldman Sachs, but another guy named John Paulson who worked with Goldman Sachs cut a deal where he secretly with Goldman Sachs sold $4 trillion worth of junk mortgages to European banks, and then secretly bet that those mortgages, he and Goldman bet that the mortgages would become worthless, and they did. They completely became worthless. They sold this stuff, and they knew it was becoming that they were selling worthless crap, and they bet that it would become worthless. This guy personally pocketed $3 billion. Personally pocketed $3 billion. The reason I bring this up is that his French assistant, a guy named Torre, his French assistant, who didn't even know what the heck was going on, he was the only one who was arrested. And by the way, he never went to jail. He lost his stockbroker's license. That was it.
Or they pick some sacrificial lamb Bernie Madoff. Madoff and hold him up, sort of. See, we're making an example of these people. Although he wasn't connected to that necessarily. Although, wasn't Goldman Sachs somehow implicated in that as well?
Yeah, I mean, these guys look. Of course, they're making these. J.P. Morgan was his big banker. That's Jamie Dimon. Now, Obama has said that Jamie Dimon is his favorite banker, and he wished that other banks run by guys like Jamie Dimon. The guy's been implicated in four criminal investigations. And he said, when Jamie Dimon, after getting $20 billion from the U.S. Treasury in bailout money, then cut himself a check for $50 million in bonus, Obama said, why is everyone picking on Jamie Dimon? Why should Jamie Dimon be punished? You know what? If Mr. President, if you don't know why Jamie Dimon should be punished, get out of the Oval Office. This guy has taken down, he took us down, okay? Predatory mortgages, fake mortgage securities, the London Whale, which was like a financial scheme, basically attempt to corner the market with shorts, which got blown apart by this chess genius who figured out the scam. I mean, these guys have been running amok with our money. And you don't know why they should be punished, Mr. President? You think that they should be, you know, what's with this guy?
So what is the end game? My previous guest, Douglas Hagman, right, argues that there is a deliberate move here to destroy the U.S. dollar.
Well, the point is that, right, you destroy it, then you build it up. It goes in circles, right? And so that these guys make money on both ends. Like I said, first they sell the bad, terrible mortgages, right? Then they bet that the mortgages will go bad. They issue the mortgages, and they know will blow apart. They bankrupt people. We had 5 million people lose their homes, Mr. Obama. And so the other thing is, yeah, so, you know, and look what, you know, this is where we get to the vultures who love to pick up when things die. That's why they're called vulture investors, because when things die, these guys eat. So the end game memo, what Geithner meant about this was the end game, is that they were going to be able to get 155 nations to sign on to opening up their markets to this derivatives junk, to this financial deregulation insanity, or they wouldn't be able to sell products to the United States, the biggest market in the world. The only nation at all that resisted was Brazil. And Brazil's the only economy that survived in the West, the only economy in our hemisphere that thrived while everyone else was on their knees, because Brazil said no. And I found another document in which we had this whole program to punish Brazil. Now, that doesn't help you or me. Why is the United States government acting for the banks to protect, to beat up Brazil? I have nothing against Brazilians. I got orange juice from there, right? I have nothing against Brazilians. I like the samba. I've been down there many times. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with Brazil. Why are they beating up Brazil? Because they won't go along with the madness. Thank God Brazil didn't go along, so at least we had one nation buying things and keeping us alive.
Nobody gets out of the empire alive, Greg.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, remember, these guys make money on the collapse, and that's where we get into this whole other group of financiers, these billionaires, the guys especially backing now, got behind Christie, vulture investors who make money when nations collapse, when industries collapse, when people collapse. These guys make tremendous profits off this. You know, we think, you know, it's not about, you know, job creation. We aren't talking, look, no one really cares if Steve Jobs made billions or Oprah makes $1 billion telling us, you know, why we should feel bad about our marriages or something. But that's not the point. We don't care about that. There are people you've never heard of, like Paul the Vulture Singer, who's a real power now in the Republican Party. Steve Cohn. These are guys who they're not making a better piece of software for you. They are hoping that you will lose your job. They are hoping your industry, they're betting on your industry dying and collapsing. They're betting on your nation collapsing into murderous civil war.
Is that what's coming out of the Harvard Business School? It's not about making things anymore. It's about flipping paper.
It's about the most devious. Unfortunately, it's coming out of my old school. I went to the University of Chicago Business School and the economics departments, I said. And unfortunately, most of these guys kind of came out of Chicago, and where they learned, you know, that it's a game. It's a horrible game, and you can bet on it's easier to make things. It's easier to burn things down than build things up. And if you bet on the fire, if you are an arsonist and you bet on a fire, you've got the game figured out. And that's what's happening. So, for example, You know, we got guys like I did a story, and it's in Vultures and Vote Rustlers, also Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, on the cover of Nation magazine. You had, and these are partners of Mitt Romney, by the way. They had grabbed a hold of Delphi Auto Parts. If there's probably some Delphi auto workers, Delco, you know, the old GM Delco parts unit, and probably you have listeners out there who worked at Delco or Delphi who know this story, at least some of it. They know that they lost their jobs. There were nearly 100,000 workers in the United States. Almost everyone lost their jobs. There were 35 plants. There were 35,000 jobs that were moved, every single one to China. Remember the auto industry was bailed out? Not the auto workers. All those Delco and Delphi workers lost their jobs. All those auto parts jobs were shipped to China. In the meantime, a group of financiers known as Vultures, they call themselves Vultures, not my name I give them, and they, as Delco was dying, they secretly bought up the shares for pennies, and then told the U.S. government, we are going, unless you give us $12 billion, we are going to shut down General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford tomorrow morning. We are going to shut down the parts. Those assembly lines will stop. These are the companies on the edge. They will not just go bankrupt. GM went bankrupt. Chrysler went bankrupt. They will be liquidated. There won't be a single car made in America unless you give us $12 billion. And Obama's car czar, himself kind of a creepy investment banker, but he said, that's extortion. And he asked the CEO of General Motors, do they really control all your parts? And he said, how long can you operate without, if these guys shut down? He said 48 hours. GM was 48 hours from complete liquidation collapse unless they got their ransom money. And Obama quietly authorized the payment, $12 billion, to these guys. And by the way, Mr. Romney made about $115 million on this.
Bingo. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's a nice transition into these vulture funds, as you say, that prey on these impoverished developing countries. And we'll probably get into this conversation after the top of the hour, at which time we will also open up the phone lines for questions or comments for Greg Palast here on Coast to Coast AM. And I have to tell you, Greg, I'm getting a ton of email and tweets, people saying, why are you just picking on Karl Rove and the Republicans? What about George Soros? What about George Soros? You want to take a couple minutes here? And I mean, is George Soros involved in and now we're going back to sort of the, you know, the election fraud and so forth. Is he or any of his NGOs involved in any of these shenanigans?
In the vote stuff, he doesn't bother anymore. All he cares about is getting marijuana legalized. I mean, he was the guy who broke the Bank of England back, but that was back when he busted the Bank of England, brought England to its knees because he bet. He had a one-way bet against the pound. He just pounded the pound. And he was the first guy to figure out that you could basically bet against the currency, and by betting against it, you could destroy it. It's, as he called it, the one-way bet. If I bet against it, I destroy it and I collect. It was good, you know, that's how you make $5 billion in the weekend.
All right. Well, I'm sure George Soros' name will come up again. As I say, we'll open up the phone lines here at the top of the hour for Greg Palast. Have at him, if you will. And we'll also talk about these vulture funds and how they prey on countries like the former Republic of Congo and Zambia and Liberia. Absolutely heart-rending story here. And you'll hear it all from Greg Palast when Coast to Coast AM continues. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay with us.